Welcome to the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast series at the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. In each episode of this series, my guest and I will discuss a work of fiction set primarily in Chicago. For this episode, we'll be discussing The Lazarus Project by Alexander Heyman, which was first published in 2008. And my guest today is Robert Eaglestone. Robert Eaglestone is Professor of Contemporary Literature and Thought at Royal Holloway University of London. He works on contemporary literature and literary theory, contemporary philosophy, and on Holocaust and genocide studies, and on the teaching of literature. He's the author of 8 books, including Contemporary Fiction from 2013, and most recently, Truth and Wonder, A Literary Introduction to Plato and Aristotle, published in 2022, which is a great book, by the way, and the editor or co-editor of 10 further books, including Brexit and Literature, published by Routledge in 2018, and the Routledge Companion to 21st Century Literary Fiction, published in 2019. He's been consulted by the UK's Department for Education on Literature Education and is on the UK Holocaust Memorial Foundation Academic Advisory Board. Welcome, Bob.
Lovely to be here.
Today we're going to discuss, as I said, The Lazarus Project by Alexander Heyman. And I guess the best place to start with this book is that it's got two different narrative strands to it. One is an imagining of a real life event from 1908, when a young man called Lazarus Averbuch, a Jewish Ukrainian immigrant who had settled in Chicago with his sister after fleeing pogrom in Russia and Ukraine, ended up in Chicago. And he then ends up at the home of the police commissioner who shoots him and kills him. And so part one strand is the recreation of that storyline and more or less the aftermath of that shooting. The novel starts, that narrative strand starts with that shooting and then follows the aftermath of it. And the second strand is the story of a novelist or a writer called Alexander Brick, who is a Bosnian immigrant who has arrived in Chicago in 1992 and missed the siege of Sarajevo and has settled in Chicago and is trying to recreate the story. So you're getting the story that he recreates, I guess, and also the story of him trying to figure out how to tell this story about Lazarus. Does that seem like a accurate summary to you?
Yeah, it does.
I guess my question for you is, like, what do these stories have to do with each other? I mean, everything and nothing feels like the cheap answer.
So I love this book. So Doug introduced me to it about 10 years ago, and I've taught it since then. And I had the great pleasure of rereading it. And thinking about what links those two stories seems to me to be, as you say, it means everything and nothing. On the one hand, it seems to be crucial to how the novel works. On the other hand, I don't know how they link. I mean, they're linked. I mean, it sounds really simple. They're linked through the title, The Lazarus Project, because both bits of the story are about bringing the dead back to life, what's at stake in that, what's possible in that, if you can do that, what happens when the dead are brought back, different kinds of death, literal, metaphorical, kind of narrative, and pulling those two things together. And it also struck me that this book is, there's now a whole kind of genre or subgenre of literary fiction or literary nonfiction, I'm not quite sure what it is, in which you get the writer telling you the story of somebody, like a kind of biography or something in someone's life, and also the writer's own kind of experience in trying to uncover or tell that story. And this seems to me both as it were, an early and outstandingly interesting version of that. And thinking about what links them together and what links the Averbuch story and the Brick story together seems to me crucial. So all the way through the Brick story, he keeps talking about the shooting in Chicago, and it's full of weird kind of resurrections. So the friend of the shooter is kind of resurrected from hiding in a toilet. And indeed, There's a scene right at the end where they pretend to rebury the shooter and somebody's hiding in his coffin. So all these kind of resurrections.
I should point out that he's not the shooter.
Oh, no, sorry.
He's
I beg your pardon. Sorry, I got carried away.
It's like, one of the points of that story, one of the whole points of the Lazarus story is that he gets immediately portrayed as a would-be assassin. Yeah. Except that he never really was a would-be assassin. He was delivering a message to the police chief and was shot 7 times, but didn't have a gun himself and never seemed to pose a threat. you're falling into the mainstream media trap, Bob.
I am. But at the same time, Brick, the novelist, is going back and trying to make alive all these dead things that happened, all the things that happened in the war in former Yugoslavia, resurrecting stories of dead people. And indeed, there's a running story about a kind of high up gangster all the way through the Brick storyline, which kind of emerges more powerfully.
So there's a couple of things there that you've hit on that I want to talk about specifically. So the gangster story, he's called Rambo in the telling of it, comes through what happens in the way I think of this is there's the story of Lazarus and then there's the story of the Lazarus Project. And the Lazarus Project is this Brick story that we're talking about. And in that Lazarus Project story, Alexander Brick and his friend Rora, who's a photographer who he runs into at the beginning at a Bosnian independence banquet, travel to Ukraine and eventually Sarajevo, retracing some of the places where Lazarus Averbuch was from and had been. So he escaped the pogrom and then ended up as a refugee for a bit and escaped the refugee camp and ended up emigrating to America. And part of what Brick is doing is tracing some of his own family heritage through those things, because there's some overlap. But the whole time, Rora is telling him these stories about the siege of Sarajevo and the wider Bosnian war, because Brick himself hasn't experienced it. And he also is telling him jokes all the way through. He tells him 4 or 5 different jokes featuring these two characters, which I want to maybe touch on at some point as well, because I think there's one of them in particular that is really relevant, or really is like the kind of key joke to some of this, what all this storytelling is about. But the story of the gangster becomes a real obsession for Brick. It's also a real obsession for a journalist within that story called William Miller, who's a New York Times journalist who's kind of embedded himself with this gangster. And you hear lots of tell of him and the things that he does and the things that he tells about this gangster. And Brick is always kind of asking too many questions about these stories that keep getting shut off. And there's just this proliferation of questions and stories. What do you think he's trying to do with that?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So it seems to me that one of Brick's key concerns is that although he's Bosnian, he's totally missed the war. And his friend Rora, who was present at the Siege of Sarajevo, keeps saying, oh, like, you're a nice bookish man, you don't know anything about this, we don't want to talk about this. And so he's got a kind of absence, almost a traumatic absence.
So there's a passage that might help illustrate that I just want to read out, and then we can maybe talk about it further, because this happens, the thing that you said about you're a nice bookish man comes quite late on, where he's like, Rora's sick of Brick constantly saying, yeah, but what about this? What about this? He's like, just listen to the story. And there's a whole thing early on about the Bosnian way of telling stories versus a kind of American way of telling stories. What's interesting about that is that in listening to Rora tell him these stories, these Bosnian stories, he's interacting with them like an American and not like a Bosnian. And he's always kind of fluctuating between his Bosnian-ness, which is also a Ukrainian-ness because he's partly of Ukrainian heritage, and his Americanness that he's reluctant to accept, but which he is also adapting to and adopting. But anyway, in the very early stages of the novel, when he's at this banquet, as I said, for the independence of Bosnia, and he meets Rora, and this is what they say to each other. "I see you never gave up photography," I said. "I took it up again in the war," he said. I knew from experience that if I who had left just before the beginning and missed the whole shebang, were to ask a Bosnian about the war, my question could easily lead to a lengthy monologue about the horrors of war and my inability to understand what it was really like. I was self-trained to avoid falling into that situation, but this time I asked, "Were you in Sarajevo for the whole siege?" "No," he said, "just for the best parts." "I came here in the spring of 1992, I said, unasked. "You were lucky," he said, and I was about to object when a whole family approached him demanding a photo. The burly, bespectacled father, the burly, short-armed mother, two burly girls with shimmeringly combed hair. They all lined up, stiffened up, and bared their burly teeth for eternal memory. Rora. So, like, this is the crux of it. Like, he really desperately needs to feel the things that everyone he loves and knows felt in the Siege of Sarajevo, but can't because he didn't experience it. And that you were lucky, he said, and I was about to object, is the whole tension there, right? Like, he was lucky, but also he feels very unlucky for having, you know, there's this thing that has been torn away from him, not just the city, but the experience of the city and the experience of all these people he loved in the city. And it's a very complicated thing. It plays out in really complicated ways in some of the stories in Alexander Heyman's first book, The Question of Bruno. There's some really excellent stories about exactly that feeling, that kind of excavate that feeling in that book. But anyway.
Well, and it's doubly intense for him because he's a writer, and the job of the writer is to uncover and explain things that are, you know, hard to explore. And that tension goes right through his writing. And it's also in the very first sentence of the first two sentences of the book. The time and place, the only things I'm certain of, March 2nd, 1908, Chicago. Beyond that is the haze of history and pain, and now I plunge. So right at the beginning, you're being told that even in the story of Lazarus, mm-hmm. gunned down by the police chief, he's reconstructing it, and it's kind of made up and a story, and yet he's kind of desperate to get to the real thing, but can't. And it's the same thing with the Lazarus Project bit of the book as well. He's desperate to get to the real thing, and he can't. And that leads to the really tragic kind of Pynchon-esque bit right at the end, where his traveling companion is gunned down. He thinks it's part of a huge plot, a narrative that he's kind of constructed and put together. And it turns out to be just a totally random drug killing.
Yeah. Well, not even a drug killing, just a killing by a drug addict.
And in
the aftermath of that, the sister of Rora spells out the truth of behind all these gangster stories that have just been the thing is, he warns you about this early in the novel. He talks about this Bosnian storytelling where you exaggerate and make things up for the sake of the story. I mean, this isn't particular to Bosnia either, but he's defining it for the terms of the novel as this Bosnian thing in this case. And it's about the story and about getting lost in the story and giving yourself over as a listener to the story that's being told to you and not questioning its truth or otherwise, because that's not the point. And yet, again, as I said, he's always demanding to know the truth. And then here you get like, well, actually, he was telling you stories all along in exactly the manner that you said stories work. And then here the truth is it's not totally divorced from the stories he's been told, but it's much simpler. It has resolutions, the actual story, in ways that Rora's versions don't.
That's right. And there's a really fantastic bit about stories. So another sort of subtext of the novel all the way through is about Brick and his wife. Mm-hmm. And their relationship has clearly kind of died. And that's also something that might need resurrecting or to be resurrected and see what happened. But there's a fantastic story that he tells her at a wedding about the Berlin mm-hmm. Wall. And it seems to be significant. It's about the Berlin Wall, so the crux of the Cold War. And the Bosnian version is that the rabbits on one side keep trying to burrow through the wall to get to mate with rabbits on the other side. And it leads to all sort of the guards being very trigger happy. But then his wife just says, well, that just doesn't sound very likely. I find that hard to believe, she says. And then she gives reasons why it's unlikely to be true. And there's a terrible kind of moment. And he says, never could I tell a story in Mary's presence after that. And so there's a kind of moment where you get these two different sorts of stories. One can be evidenced and make sensed and judged by something outside themselves, mm-hmm. by the historical record or by common sense. And the others are judged by the storiness of the story, like the jokes you talk about. And that seems to be a really interesting tension throughout the novel. And I kept thinking, in the Lazarus section, is it, to use the framework of the novel, is it kind of Bosnian exaggeration or is it American fact-telling? And it seems to be a really interesting tension. You just don't know.
Yeah, so I've got a complicated response to that, I guess. And the direct answer to your question, I suppose, is that it's like part of this is that there is a factual record of Lazarus Averbuch and what happened, and he's using that source material to tell a story. But like a lot of things, that factual account doesn't add up in a satisfying way, right? Like the rabbits in the Berlin Wall can just mate with the other rabbits in the no man's land of the Berlin Wall doesn't add up in a satisfying way. And so them trying to burrow under the wall to mate with West German rabbits is a, you know, a fiction or an embellishment or a, that tries to tell you something else about what the facts can't seem to portray. And there's, I mean, that's, I guess, one of the impulses behind the thing that you mentioned earlier about this kind of mode of writing factual stories and telling the story of it, the fabrication of the factual story. It's also one of the motivations behind writing a fact-based fictional work.
Yeah.
But then the other thing is like, well, okay, but what's the actual layered, nuanced meaning of those tensions? And this is me doing a lot of, I think stretching, but I don't think it's actually stretching. I think there's three points in this novel where deliberately or not, that tension is kind of put on display, or the reason for approaching these stories in these ways are put on display in isolated moments. And so in my edition, those moments are on page 44, on page 105, and page 208, and they're all different things, and they kind of pull, I think, the Ukrainian Bosnian aspects of the story, the Lazarus Project part of the story, and the Chicago parts of the story, which belong in part to the Lazarus Project part and part to the Lazarus Averbuch story, pull them together. And so the first one is when Rora and Brick first go out to try and kind of, they wander around the places in Chicago where Lazarus Averbuch would have lived and the things would have happened. And this is a paragraph that starts to explain this. It'll be familiar to people from Chicago as well, the kind of politics of what's happening here, which is quite complicated. But anyway, we crossed erected bridges. We crossed erected bridges on our way to Maxwell Street, past arbitrary stop signs, drove by ghastly warehouses that were to be converted into ghastly lofts. We followed a People's Energy truck into Chicago's new great neighborhood where the ghetto once stood. Nothing from the days of Lazarus survived. Among glassy buildings and condemned church spires, there were colossal crane skeletons. Money castles rose over the space where the Maxwell Street Market used to be, where in Lazarus's times peddlers had peddled and liquefied rot had clotted in the gutters, where the streets used to teem with people and gossip used to spread like flu. Here children had grown up. Here families had lived on different floors of the same tenement, sorted by generations, yet often dying out of order, children first, grandparents last. Here the English language taught by charitable church-going American ladies had been transformed by their students into a sonorous mess of old world inflections. It goes on and on. It's a long paragraph, and I don't want to take up our time reading the whole thing. But at the end, they don't take any pictures because there's just nothing there of Lazarus to see. And what's interesting is this place and the layers of story and history in this one place, Maxwell Street, because it's the same area where you see the tail end of it in the Blues Brothers film when they go into the diner and they're outside and you have
Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, but before that, you have outside, you have John Lee Hooker playing on sitting on an amplifier and playing, and that was just before they tore down, you know, the rest of Maxwell Street Market. So it develops into this other thing, and is a kind of cradle of the electric blues. But the market, you know, lasted until they tore it down to expand the university. And there's a whole story there, but none of that is there. It's all just what's left now, and these layers have kind of been effaced. And he's trying to see them and trying to understand them. And telling the story is partly about trying to do that. And then but that's about a place. And that's about the layers that exist historically and in story between Brick and Lazarus. And what he can, the kind of problem that faces him in trying to uncover and trying to tell a story. But then on page 105, he says, this is where he's gone. He's looking at in a cemetery in Ukraine. A human face consists of other faces, the faces you inherited or picked up along the way, or the ones you simply made up, laid on top of each other in messy superimposition. And this is a kind of version of that Maxwell Street thing put into the face of a person. And he's talking about the layers of generations and also the layers of experience that inform an individual. So the face is here kind of a metaphor, a symbol for identity and how one understands oneself. So that's part of the piece. It's not just about the place, Maxwell Street in that first example, but it's also about this person and the individual. And then on page 208 there in Sarajevo, again, this place that he left before the siege and is trying to re-understand, I suppose, himself. But he says this. He says, "When I went to Sarajevo a couple of years ago, I said, I found out that if I looked into the faces of the people, I saw what they used to look like. I saw their old faces, not their new faces. And when I walked among the prettied up ruins and bullet-riddled facades, I saw what they used to be, not what they were now. I x-rayed through the visible and saw I was the original past version. I couldn't see the now, only the before. And I had the feeling that if I could really see what it really looked like now, I would forget what it was before." God damn it, Brick. You like to listen to yourself. How does your wife put up with it? But that's really profound to me, that moment, because it ties the other two things together, right? He's seeing the faces and he's seeing through the experiences that he doesn't understand. And he's seeing through their contemporary faces to their past, and he's seeing through the ruined buildings through to the what they used to be. And in Maxwell Street, he can only see what's there now because he doesn't know that other stuff. And I just think it's that illustrates the tensions of these storytellings and starts to point you towards why you tell stories in this way. Anyway, that was a very long answer.
Yeah. So can I say a few things about that? So I want to say some small things and some big things. So just kind of in passing, that long paragraph you read about Maxwell Street just shows you one of the things that's brilliant about this novel is the kind of density of it. So just in those few lines you read, you got all sorts of images and histories and all put together just brilliantly. So money castles rose over the space. You know exactly what he means by a money castle and everything summoned up in that image. And we know it's like an old European image, like a castle, as well as a new American one put together so brilliantly. And with the faces to your second one about in the graves. So my thought about that is, I'll come to your third passage in a second, is that when I was younger, I thought that writers would be able to say kind of everything. And now it seems to me, and it seems to be one of the things in this novel, that there are things that language or writers can't get to. And I wonder with the Maxwell Street example, whether he's pointing to the fact that you cannot articulate some kinds of human experience or pastness in language, or whether he's suggesting that by digging through and kind of archaeology, you can get to those things. And similarly with the faces, I take the point about kind of digging through the faces and people's experience. But it seems to me there are kind, so now I believe, in a way that I didn't, that there are human experiences that you can talk about, but you can't properly put into writing. And those might be experiences of pain or of atrocity or of grieving, maybe. And then the third passage in relation to what I've just said is really interesting. So he says that he's in Sarajevo, he's seeing them through with his kind of x-ray, seeing the past version, but in seeing the past version, he can't see the present. So in that one, he's saying you can kind of get through the, you can see with your x-ray eyes through the visible to the past, but in seeing the past, you can no longer see the
and vice present. Versa.
Yeah, that's still a kind of stuckness,
yeah,
isn't it? So it's almost the question is like, how do you get from there to here or from here to there? And that's where things are stuck. And that's where, although he takes a journey through Ukraine and Sarajevo, he doesn't kind of get there.
Well, you get the impression through that journey to Sarajevo that Brick, he goes in almost like naively, like he gets this big grant to go and do this travels, and he's excited about it. And he can do this, put together this story that he's been desperate to put together. And you get the sense that he kind of goes into it pretty naively thinking, oh, I'll go and experience some things and I'll be able to finally put this all together. And what he keeps realizing, and again, this is part of the stories that he's being told by his friend are about, is like he's just accumulating more stories that he has to try and triangulate against each other. And if you have, so like if you have the two stories in the Sarajevo passage we were just talking about, it's fairly straightforward to see how that works and what the problems are. You can either look through things to the past and miss what's in front of you, or you can look at what's in front of you and no longer see the past. That's complicated, but easy to get your imagination around. But when you start to triangulate all these other different aspects, you know, at one point he says early on that Bosnian is a citizenship, not an ethnicity. And then a lot of the book is about ethnic cleansing, the consequences, the lived consequences of ethnic cleansing, the practical lived individual consequences of that. And so there's something complicated that you have to then try and look in a couple of different ways at, and also look at the past and the present, and also look at the Chicago and the Sarajevo, and also look, you know, it just, the things pile up, and trying to keep that into a unified whole is really difficult. It's, you know, you're looking at all those generations of faces, but it's not just a person, it's a whole bunch of people, it's a whole cultures of people, it's whole experiences and histories. And he seems desperate to try and keep them, try and find a way to make them cohere. And I can understand why. And it's part of what makes this book so good, is that he's constantly upfront about trying to do that, I suppose.
And that leads me to think two things. One is that in that simple, straightforward way, it doesn't cohere. I mean, that's one of the things that makes the book work, in that it doesn't have nice, simple answers to things. And it's not all, I went to Sarajevo and discovered this and it was all right. It's quite the opposite of that. But actually, all the way through, and I really noticed it this time, is his emphasis, exactly as you said, on telling, on story making, on what kind of stories we make. So one of the recurring tropes is Lazarus's sister trying to write to her mother about what's happened.
Yeah.
And she begins 7 or 8 letters in her imagination. And then Brick starts doing that to talk to his wife or to other people, imagining how you might write. And in fact, they're not being the right words to say. And in fact, all the way through, I kept thinking, people are telling stories all the time here. I mean, there are some really obvious examples. So the Miller journalist, there's also a journalist called Miller in the Lazarus section, who embroiders a huge story about anarchists. And he gives Olga, the sister, a kind of, what do I want to call it, a kind of faux newspaper dignity in mourning that she doesn't really feel. So So he's embroidering this huge story just as the police
I want to interject for a moment on that. Sorry. Because yeah. I think it's – no, it's fine. So like, there's William P. Miller, the Chicago Tribune – or not Tribune, sorry. It's like the forerunner to the Tribune journalist who tells this like virulently anti-Semitic and xenophobic and lurid kind of tabloid tale of the attempted assassination on Shippey, which is nothing of the sort. It's very similar actually to what happens in, this is just an aside, but it's very similar to what happens in Native Son to Bigger Thomas, where like this yeah. incident happens and the media storm creates this lurid story about him and about what happened. That in Native Son bears more relation to the truth than it does in this one, but the truth is much more slippery in this novel than that as well. But so there's that, and you've characterized how he creates the sister, and then there's William Miller. So William P. Miller, the Lazarus story journalist, is doing this kind of tabloid thing, and then there's William Miller, the New York Times journalist in the Lazarus Project story, or in Rora's stories within the Lazarus Project story, who is an interesting foil because he seems to think he's a more, like, we kind of sneer at a little bit at the William P. Miller because you get these long quoted passages from his articles and they're so wide of what's going on, and he's so embedded in the police department that he's got no perspective or doesn't want to even have a perspective on what's actually going on. But William Miller, the New York Times journalist, is the same, just from, he's so excited about his being embedded with this big gangster, this Serbian gangster, that he's not offering any perspective. You never get to hear any of his journalism either. He's a totally mute character. He's just a character in this story's being told.
And I also think that both those journalists work as a kind of, I mean, we're told, Brick says, oh, there's American narratives that are kind of true and Bosnian ones that are exaggerated. But in fact, that works as a kind of critique of American narratives because they're also completely kind of exaggerated and
And made it's up. Just the expectation or the assumption is that they're true. Yeah. It's a different assumption, whatever you're bringing to it. But that was me cutting you off on your points.
Yeah.
Do carry on.
So one of the recurring tropes in the novel is just people telling stories. There's always stories and stories within stories and stories about stories. And there's the jokes you talk about and the letters. And also people are always giving accounts to each other about things. And some of the stories are fake. So Olga, the sister, is kind of taken away from the police by a strange Jewish business person who turns out to have kind of quite complicated motives that he constantly lies about. So it's full of these stories being told. And I think that what holds it together is exactly the kind of, there must be a better word, the storifying. So you're presented with lots and lots of these different stories and you're kind of invited to judge the different kinds of stories that you're constantly getting.
Yeah. And who's telling them? So Tauba, the Jewish businessman, he's trying to basically manipulate Olga into doing things that Lazarus's sister into doing things that will be of benefit to the sort of mainstream acculturated Jewish community of Chicago, and she's not really having it.
Yeah.
She just won't. She sees through him, and at one point he says, "Oh, think of the pogroms and what happened and how we don't want to repeat that again." And she calls him out in a really interesting way because he hasn't experienced it, and she has, and she says, "Never speak to me of the pogroms." He's from Vienna. There's a point it's made that he speaks German in a Viennese accent. And she at first refuses to speak German to him. She replies to everything he says in Yiddish. There's an interesting thing with the languages in which stories are told in this novel and how Haman, the author, reports those languages, because the languages of the official languages, basically, and languages of empire, German, Russian, Ukrainian when they're in Ukraine, English are put in quotation marks, and the other languages, the sort of the secondary or minor or oppressed or whatever you want to say, languages are always done without. So like in Ukraine, Brick and Rora speak to each other in Bosnian, and there's never quotation marks around it. And then when he's speaking to somebody in Ukrainian, there are. I think it's just a really small, clever, interesting textural thing that he does. And so she's saying these things to him in German. You know, he's telling her about her own experience, and he becomes a kind of foil, but not an exact one for Brick, you know, like wanting, not having had this direct experience and not understanding, you know, the difference is that Brick wants to understand and has a sympathy for understanding and an empathy and sees these layers of faces, whereas Tauba is more cynical. But it's still an interesting, it's another one of those little pieces that you have to see through to several sides of in order to see the whole. And that's another very difficult thing to do. And it's the role of the stories, to come back to your main point, it's the role of the stories in this overall story, and how many of them. Olga is constantly writing, as I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to bring it up at almost exactly the same point. She tries to tell her mother that everything's fine. She tries to tell her mother that Lazarus is dead, and she can never do it in any way that gets to the bottom of what actually is going on, because she can't understand.
And then we're also kind of warned about stories. So one of the things that I think is really moving is that in the outside toilet that Olga and Lazarus have, there's a Russian English dictionary, and Olga is sitting in the toilet, kind of getting out of the way of the police, but also kind of struck with grief, and she's reading the L section they were at. So it's lout, lovable, love, lovely, lover, low, lower, lowly, lowly, Lord, what I've done. And then 2 pages later, she's back with the L's, look, loom, lose. And so the dictionary words start to become a story, like look, loom, lose. And that's what's happened to the Avonbrook family, I guess. And so we're also being, I always think of that Nietzsche remark about, you know, human beings are condemned to meaning. So in the Lazarus Project, we're condemned to these stories all the time, even though the stories sometimes work and sometimes don't. And I just think that's such a powerful, I mean, that's a powerful thing that holds it together. And I know that sounds the sort of thing literary critics say, that, you know, it's held together by the very act of storytelling, but it really is.
Sorry, I thought you were going to keep going.
No, I just finished with enthusiasm.
It really and some jazz hands that the listeners will never see. I think that the what I'm about to respond with is kind of gets into the why that storytelling is all we have. So I'm on page 235. They're in the cemetery, and he says, some part of my life ended there among those empty graves. It was then that I started mourning. I can tell you that now that there is little but mourning. And it's like the stories are partly the way to articulate something that is otherwise unarticulable. We've talked about that quite a bit already, even though they don't quite get you there. You know, the mourning there is about that unarticulable grief that you were talking about a few minutes ago.
And in fact, the grave they look at says Avonbrook Isaac 1901-1913. Mm-hmm. And like I said, right, the first line of the novel is the time and place, the only things I'm certain of.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, the Avonbrook Isaac 1901-1913 is a kind of narrative, which is kind of certain, and that's all there is. So there are some kind of, there are some facts and dates, but only a tiny amount in a huge kind of penumbra of uncertainty and grief and fear and anxiety.
Yeah, this is going to bring me to, I'm going to slide down the page a little, that same page a little further, and then connect it to the jokes that Rora tells and one other thing, because that's the other piece of storytelling puzzle that we need to put into this. He says, so they get lost in the cemetery a bit. It took a while to find a way out. Rora's hair was sweat pasted to his skull and neck, a great oval of perspiration growing on his back. The closer we got to the exit, the bigger it was. And again, I thought, that's me. The thought bounced in my head deliriously. I couldn't get to the end of it, could not fold it up into meaning. Yuliana walked behind. She's their guide. I heard her gentle panting. She was me. Rora was me. And then we came upon the man on the bench, drooling asleep, his mouth open enough for us to see a graveyard of teeth, his hand wedged inside his pants waist. And he was me too. The only one who was not me was myself. Then, he's struggling to put together, a picture of how to make a coherent understanding out of these things. And part of the way you do that is by going out of yourself and, the empathizing with other people, but that's not quite sufficient enough either. And this is, to me, the key joke that Rora tells him. He tells all these stories about these jokes about Mujo and Suljo at various points. There's five or six of them in the novel. And this, to me, on page 237 is the one that's most important. Mujo left Sarajevo and went to America, to Chicago. He wrote regularly to Suljo, trying to convince him to come, but Suljo did not want to, reluctant to leave his friends and his kafana. Finally, after a few years, Mujo convinces him, and Suljo flies over the ocean, and Mujo waits for him at the airport with a huge Cadillac. They drive downtown from the airport, and Mujo says, "See that building, 100 stories high?" "I see it," Suljo says. "Well, that's my building." "Nice," Suljo says. "And see that bank at the bottom floor?" "I see it. That's my bank." "And see that silver Rolls Royce parked in the front?" "I see it. That's my Rolls Royce." "Congratulations," Suljo says. "You've done well for yourself." They drive to the suburbs, and Mujo points at a house as big and white as a hospital. "See that house? That's my house," Mujo says. "And see the pool, Olympic size, by the house? That's my pool. There's a gorgeous, curvaceous woman sunbathing by the pool, and there are three healthy children happily swimming in it. See that woman? That's my wife. And those children are my children." "Very nice," Suljo says. "But who is that brawny, suntanned young man massaging your wife?" "Well," Mujo says, "that's me." that joke is really funny, but also it's the same story that he experiences in the cemetery, just in a different setting and everything. But it's something about how do you imagine yourself? How you imagine yourself in a situation, in a strange situation, some of them enforced, some of them by choice. How do you make coherence of that? And on page 257, he says, he's talking about the dreams that he has. He says, "We did it in Chicago, though once or twice we got together in Sarajevo too. Everything was always taking place before the war, though we always knew it was coming. From such dreams, I woke up bereaved, for the we, whoever we were, the we could never be assembled but in a dream." And I think this is the third part of those three things. It's like, that's me. I want that to be me. The only one who's not me is me. How do I turn all these me's into we? How can I be watching the man massaging my wife and also be the man massaging my wife only in a dream, only in a story?
Yeah. So I completely agree with that. So I think that joke, the that's me joke, is really significant. I mean, not only because Brick feels a kind of imposter in his marriage, an imposter in Chicago, and also an imposter back in Sarajevo in a way. And as you say, you can only get it in a dream or a story. And that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to storify the whole thing. But the story kind of doesn't work. We would never be assembled but in a dream. Picking out that line makes me think of those great writers like Ngugi who say, we must be the Shakespeare for our people. We must tell a story that embraces everything. But I think the reason he can't do that is revealed again by another recurring trope, which again occurs on this pages which we've been talking about. It's on 236. It's right after the cemetery scene that you discussed. And he says to the guide, "Tell me, Yuliana," I said, envisioning her hand in my hand, "tell me, what is this world about, life or death?" Rora looked at me with a knowing smile, But what it was he knew, I did not know. That's the crucial thing, because Rora has experience. That's a very strange question, she said. What do you mean? Is this world for the dead or for the living? Do you think there are more dead than living people? Why do you worry about that? And then he goes on, if there are more dead than living, then the world is about death. And the question is, what are we to do with all the death? Who is going to remember all the dead? But then a little bit later on, Juliana says, I think it's about life. I think there's always more life than death. And this question about, is the world for the living or for the dead? And the kind of role of memory or the role of life is, again, it goes right the way through the whole book. And Olga, Lazarus's sister, asks it. And we're constantly being asked to kind of balance, not being asked to balance. We're being shown a kind of memorial and the weight of the memory of the dead, and we're being shown the carelessness and the thoughtlessness of the living. And those two, they, like in a less good novel, those two would match up or there'd be some kind of resolution. And here there is no resolution, because if you like, the brick character can't work out what the right answer is. He can't choose what the right answer is. And I think that's one of the reasons it's a great piece of writing, because it doesn't give you a pat answer to anything, to this key question. Is life about is the world for the dead or for the living? And I just think, and that's also why there are so many, there are lots of kind of comic scenes of people being thoughtless in the present. And I kept thinking, and then some of those are jokes and some of those are terrible stories. I think, why is he telling all these stories? And partially it's to illustrate that Bosnian way of telling stories. And partially it's because to show the thoughtlessness of the living, like the man who shoots, the junkie who shoots his friend in the end. It's exactly the thoughtlessness of the living about living and death. Whereas it is as if, it is as if the dead think only about the dead. And quite often characters say, oh, well, God deals with the dead, or the dead will look after the dead. But again, the whole point of the book, The Lazarus Project, is about the mixing up of the living and the dead, and how, you know, what happens when the dead speak to us, or what happens if you're dead and come back to life, or how you make the dead live. And it's so the book is trying to answer or resolve that tension between the living and the dead, and it just can't.
Yeah, and it's what makes it such a rich novel, such an exciting novel to read, and this is maybe the third time I've read this novel, and it, like, going back to it and rereading it was just as good as the first time I read it, because there's just more and more things seep out of it and give you more and more of a picture to think about and puzzle over and feel like really moved by as well. This seems like a great place to end our conversation. And I
have one more thing to say.
Okay. If you hadn't interrupted me, we could have edited the one more thing you had to say in. So go ahead and say it.
So I was also really struck by the religion in it. So there's lots of kind of failed religion. They're very aware about the genocide of Muslims, and they're aware there's kind of fake Christianity and hypocrites, all those sorts of things. And of course, there's pogroms and Jews. And there's lots of religion all the way through, which is obviously a crucial part of the war in former Yugoslavia. And it's called the Lazarus Project, which is a religious kind of image. And yet, I'm stuck with the epigraph, which is from the Gospels. When he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with rags. So we think about all the terrible things that the dead have gone through. And the face was covered with a cloth. And again, that's almost an epigraph for the novel, because the you can't see the faces. They're always kind of covered. And it seemed to me a pat answer to all these problems would be a religious answer. Mm-hmm. And the book goes out of its way to not do that. And I think that's really, really powerful. It's a kind of really powerful bit of way of thinking about the resolution of stories and how we can't resolve them.
It's in the last sentence of that epigraph, Jesus saith unto them, loose him and let him go. All you can do is loose him and let him go. and there's no, you know, there's no resolution.
Yeah.
Robert Eagleston, I want to thank you so much for joining me to talk to me about The Lazarus Project by Alexander Heyman. It was a really great, interesting conversation. We could go on and on and on, but we will wrap it up there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.